6. The Match Factory. First priority, Case tells Damien's flat, hearing her father's voice. Secure the perimeter. Wynne Pollard, 25 years an evaluator and improver of physical security for American embassies worldwide, had retired to develop and patent humane crowd control barriers for rock concerts. His idea of a bedtime story had been the quiet, systematic, and intricately detailed recitation of how he'd finally secured the sewer connections at the Moscow embassy. She looks at the white-painted door and guesses it to be made of oak. Like so many things Victorian, far more solidly built than it ever needed to be. Hinges are on the inside, as they should be, and this means that it swings inward, toward a blank section of wall. She judges the distance between door and wall, then looks at the table. She gets the yellow tape she'd noticed earlier from beneath the sink, using it to measure the length of the table, then the distance between the closed and chained door and the wall. 8 centimetres to spare, and with the table in position, lengthwise, between door and wall, it will require either a fire axe or explosives to get into the flat. She transfers the telephone, cable modem, keyboard, speakers and studio display monitor to the carpet, without disconnecting them or shutting the cube down. The screen wakes when she does this, and she sees Asian Slut still there, same position. When she moves the cube itself, her hand accidentally covers its static switch. It powers off. She touches the spot to reboot and turns to the table, the top of which lifts easily off the two trestles. It's heavy and solid, but Case is one of those slight-looking women who combine considerable wiry strength with low body weight. This had made her, in college, a much better rock climber than her psychologist boyfriend, to his ongoing and increasing annoyance. She would invariably reach the top first, never intentionally, and always by a more challenging route. She props the tabletop against the wall, beside the door, and goes back for the trestles. Returning with them, one in either hand, she positions them, then picks up the tabletop and lowers it, careful not to scuff Damien's freshly painted wall, unchains and unlocks the door, opening it the 8 centimetres the table now allows. This proves to be not even enough to produce a gap to peer through. Perimeter secured, she closes the door, relocking and chaining it. She sees that the cube is showing her that it wasn't properly shut down, so she kneels beside it and clicks that that's okay. When she gets to the desktop, she reopens the browser and looks at the memory again, seeing that Asian Slut still hasn't moved itself. Seeing it there, this time, causes her a residual hair prickle. But she gets past that by forcing herself to open it. To her considerable and unexpected relief, it turns out not to be snuff or torture, or even anything singularly nasty. What these women deserve, evidently, is active attention from erect penises. These being, in that way of visual porn for men, weirdly disembodied, as though one were to imagine they had arrived at the brink of a particular orifice through no individual human agency whatever. When she exits, she has to click her way past an opportunistic swarm of linked sites, and some of these, in split-second glances, look considerably worse than Asian Sluts. Now, in browser memory, FFF is followed twice by Asian Sluts, as if to prove a point. She's trying to remember what would have come after securing the perimeter in Wynne's bedtime stories. Probably maintaining the routine of the station. Psychological prophylaxis, she thinks he called it. Get on with ordinary business. Maintain morale. How many times has she turned to that in the past year or so? Hard to know what that would consist of, here and now. But then she thinks of FFF and the frenzy of posts the new footage will have generated. She'll make a pot of tea sub, cut up an orange, sit cross-legged on Damien's carpet, and see what's going on. Then she'll decide what she should do about Asian sluts and Dorothea Benedetti. Not the first time she's used FFF that way. She wonders, really, if she ever uses it any other way. It is the gift of OT, off-topic. Anything other than the footage is off-topic. The world, really. News, off-topic. In the kitchen, boiling water, she drifts back to her father's bedtime descriptions of that perimeter containment job in Moscow. She'd always secretly wanted the KGB spy devices to make it through, because she'd only ever been able to envision them as tiny clockwork brass submarines, as intricate in their way as Fabergé eggs. She'd imagined them evading each of Wynne's snares, one by one, and surfacing in the bowls of staff toilets, tiny gears buzzing. But this had made her feel guilty, because it was Wynne's job and his passion to keep them from doing that. And she'd never been able to imagine exactly what it was they were there to do, or what they'd need to do next, in order to get on with it. Damien's kettle starts to whistle. She fills the pot. Settled in picnic mode before the cube, she opens FFF and sees that the posts have indeed been flying. But also, to a certain extent, that the shit has been hitting the fan. Parker Boy and Mama Anarchia are flaming one another again. Parker Boy is de facto spokesperson for the progressives, those who assume that the footage consists of fragments of a work in progress, something unfinished, and still being generated by its maker. The completists, on the other hand, a relative but articulate minority, are convinced that the footage is comprised of snippets from a finished work, one whose maker chooses to expose it piecemeal and in non-sequential order. Mama Anarchia is the consummate completist. The implications of this, for some FFF regulars, border on the theological, but it's fairly simple for Case. If the footage consists of clips from a finished film, of whatever length, every footage head, for whatever reason, is being toyed with, unmercifully teased, in one of the most annoying fashions ever devised. The footage heads who discovered and connected the earliest known fragments had, of course, to entertain the completist possibility. When there were 5 fragments, or a dozen, it seemed more easily possible that these might be parts of some relatively short work, perhaps a student effort, however weirdly polished and strangely compelling. But as the number of downloads grew, and the mystery of their common origin deepened, many chose to believe that they were being shown these bits of a work in progress, and possibly in the order in which they were being completed. And whether you held that the footage was mainly live action, or largely computer-generated, the evident production values had come increasingly to argue against the idea of a student effort, or indeed of anything amateur in the usual sense. The footage was simply too remarkable. It had been Parker Boy, shortly after Ivy had started the site from her sole apartment, who had first raised the possibility of what he called the Garage Kubrick. This was not a concept that argued from either a completist or progressive position, necessarily, with Mama Anarchia herself quite contentedly using the term today, even though she knows that it originated with Parker Boy. It is simply a part of the discourse, and a central one, that it is possible that this footage is generated single-handedly by some technologically empowered solo auteur, some guerrilla creator, out there alone in the night of the internet. That it might be being generated via some sort of CGI, actors, sets and all, and entirely at the virtual hand of some secretive, and perhaps unknown, genius, has become a widespread obsession with a large faction of progressives, and with many completists as well, though the completists necessarily put that in past tense. But here is Parker Boy, railing on about Mama Anarchia's tendency to quote Baudrillard and the other Frenchmen who annoy him so deeply. And Case automatically hits respond and gives him her boilerplate oil upon the waters copy. This always happens when we forget that this site is only here because Ivy is willing to expend the time and energy to keep it here. And neither Ivy nor most of the rest of us enjoy it when you or anyone else starts yelling. Ivy is our host. We should try to keep this a pleasant place for her. And we shouldn't take it too much for granted that FFF will always be here. She clicks on post and watches her name and message title appear under his. Case P, and keep your shirt on. Because Parker Boy is her friend, she can get away with this, where someone else couldn't. She has become a sort of ritual referee, charged specifically with flagging down Parker Boy whenever he goes off on anyone, as he's definitely inclined to do. Ivy can whip him into shape pronto, but Ivy is a policewoman in Seoul, works long shifts, and can't always be on the site to moderate. She automatically clicks reload, and his response is already there. "Where are you?" NT.
"London. Working."
NT. And all of this is hugely comforting. Psychological prophylaxis, evidently. The phone rings beside the cube. Mirror World rings she finds unnerving at the best of times. She hesitates, then answers.
"Hello?"
"Case, dear, it's Bernard.
Stone Street.
Helena and I were wondering if you'd be up for a little dinner."
"Thank you, Bernard."
Looking at the trestle table blocking the door.
"But I'm feeling unwell."
"Jet lag. You can try Helena's little pills."
"It's kind of you, Bernard, but..."
"Hubertus will be here. He'll be horribly disappointed if he doesn't have a chance to see you."
"Aren't we meeting Monday?"
"He's in New York tomorrow evening. Can't be here for our meeting. Oh, say you'll come." This is one of those conversations in which Case feels that the British have evolved passive-aggressive leverage in much the way they've evolved irony. She has no way of securing the perimeter here once she leaves the flat, but this Blue Ant contract represents a good quarter of her anticipated year's gross.
"PMS, Bernard,"
not to put it too delicately. "Then you absolutely have to come. Helena has something completely marvellous for that."
"Have you tried it?"
"Tried what?" She gives up. Company of almost any kind seems not entirely a bad idea.
"Where are you?"
"Docklands, 7. It's casual. I'll send a car. Delighted you can come. Bye." Stone Street rings off with an abruptness Case suspects has required some learning in New York. There is ordinarily a sing-song, almost tender cadence to the Mirror World termination of telephone conversations, a call and response of farewell she's never mastered. Psychological prophylaxis is shot to hell. 3 minutes later, having Googled North London locksmith, she's on the phone with a man at something called Judge Advocate Locks.
"You don't work on Saturdays," she opens, hopefully.
7 days a week, 24 hours a day."
"But you wouldn't be able to get here before this evening, would you?"
"Where are you?"
She tells him.
15 minutes, he says.
"You don't take visa."
"We do."
As she hangs up, she realizes that she's lost Dorothea's number by making this call. Not that she would necessarily have been able to extract it from the phone, but it was the closest thing she had to evidence of the entire episode, other than Asian sluts on the browser memory. She presses redial, just to check, and gets the man at Judge Advocate.
"Sorry,"
she says.
"Hit redial by mistake." 14 minutes, he says, defensive now. And the truck arrives in more like 12.
An hour later, Damien's door has two entirely new,
and very expensive German locks, with keys that looked like something you might find if you took apart a very up-to-date automatic pistol. The cube is back on the table, in its accustomed place. She didn't change the lock on the street door, because she doesn't know Damien's tenants, or even how many there are. Dinner with Big End. She groans and goes to change. The car and driver from Blue Ant are waiting when she exits the street door, the two new keys on a black shoestring around her neck. She's hidden the set of spares behind one of Damien's mixing consoles in the upstairs room. Evening now. A light rain just beginning to fall. She thinks of it thinning the children's crusade still further, under the giant Fimo boots and aeroplanes and the street lamps mounted with surveillance cameras. Settled in the car's rear seat, she asks the driver, a slender and immaculate African, for the name of the station nearest their destination.
Bow Road, he says.
But she doesn't know it. She looks at the back of his meticulously shorn head, at the niobium stud in the upper curve of his right ear, then out at passing shop fronts and restaurants. Stone Street's casual will translate as relatively dressy by her standards, so she's opted for the CPU Damien calls skirt thing, a long, narrow, anonymously made tube of black jersey, with only the most minimal hemming at either end. Tight, but comfortable, rides the hips well, infinitely adjustable in terms of length. Under this, black hose. Over it, a black DKNY cardigan, underkinied with a pair of nail scissors. New old stock pumps from a vintage place in Paris. And finds herself thinking wistfully of racketing along in the metro and of the impossibly great way Parisian women have of wearing scarves. She decides that this is either another sign of serotonin normalisation, daydreaming of another place, or a get-the-hell-out-of-dodge reaction to Asian sluts on the browser. This increasingly massive and entirely unresolved issue she now has with Dorothea, someone she'd scarcely known existed. She's searched her memory for any way in which she might previously have earned this woman's enmity, but has found nothing. She is not much in the business of making enemies, although the quieter side of her profession, the sort of yay or nay evaluation Blue Ant is currently paying her for, can be problematic. A nay can cost a company a contract, or an employee, once an entire department, a job. The rest of it, the actual running to earth of street fashion, the occasional lectures to intent platoons of executives, generates remarkably little ill will. A red double-decker grinds past, registering less as Mirror World than as some Disney prop for Londonland. On a wall, she spies freshly shingled copies of a still from the new fragment. It is The Kiss. Already. In New York, once, on an uptown train in rush hour during the anthrax scares, as she'd mentally recited the duck mantra, she'd found herself looking at a still no bigger than a business card, frame-grabbed and safety-pinned, from a fragment she'd not yet seen, on the green polyester uniform blazer of a weary-looking black woman. Case had been using the mantra to ward off a recurring fantasy that they would drop light bulbs full of the very purest stuff on the subway tracks, where, as she too well remembered Wynne once having told her, it would take only a few hours, as the army had evidently proven in experiments in the 1960s, to drift from 14th to 59th Street. The black woman, seeing her notice the little still, had nodded, recognising a fellow follower, and Case had been rescued from inner darkness by this suggestion of just how many people might be following the footage, and just how oddly invisible a phenomenon that was. There are many more now, in spite of a general, and in her opinion entirely welcome, lack of attention from the major media. Whenever the media do try to pick it up, It slides like a lone noodle from their chopsticks. It comes in moth-like, and a radar evolved to detect things with massive airframes. A species of ghost, or black guest, perhaps. As Damien had once explained, hackers and their more autonomous creations are known in China. Shows dealing with lifestyles and popular culture, or with minor mysteries made to seem major, have aired the story, along with dubiously assembled sequences of fragments. But these elicited no viewer response whatever, except on FFF, of course, where the assemblages are ripped to shreds amid lengthy and passionate protestations of just how clueless it is to put, say, number 23 before number 58. Footage heads seem to propagate primarily by word of mouth, or, as with Case, by virtue of random exposure, either to a fragment of video or to a single still frame. Case's first footage had been waiting for her as she'd emerged from the flooded all-genders toilet at a Nolita gallery party that previous November. Wondering what she could do to sterilise the soles of her shoes and reminding herself never to touch them again, she'd noticed two people huddled on either side of a third, a turtleneck man with a portable DVD player held before him in the way that creche figures of the Three Kings hold their gifts. And passing these three, she'd seen a face there, on the screen of his ciborium. She'd stopped without thinking, and done that stupid duck dance, trying to better align retina to pixel. "What is that?" she'd asked. A sideways look from a girl with hooded eyes, a sharp and avian nose, round steel lebret stud gleaming from beneath her lower lip. "Footage," this one had said. And for Case, it had started there. She'd left the gallery with the URL for a site that offered all of the footage accumulated to that point. Ahead now, in the wet evening light, a twirling blue pulse, as of something meant to warn of whirlpools, vortices. They are in some larger thoroughfare, multi-lane traffic verging on gridlock. The blue ant car slowing, halting, locked in from behind, then edging forward. As they pass the scene of the accident, Case sees a bright yellow motorcycle on its side, front forks twisted strangely. The whirling blue light is mounted on a slender mast, rising from a larger, obviously official motorcycle parked nearby. And she sees that this is an emergency medical response vehicle, an entirely mirror world concept, able to edge through the densest traffic to an accident site. The bike medic, in a bell staff jacket with huge reflective stripes, is kneeling above the fallen rider, whose helmet is on the pavement beside him, and whose neck is immobilised in a foam collar. The medic is giving the man oxygen with a mask and bottle, and now Case realises she can hear the insistent hooting from somewhere behind of a mirror world ambulance. And for an instant, she sees that unconscious, unmarked face, its lower half obscured by the transparent mask, the evening's rain falling on closed eyes, and knows that this stranger may now inhabit the most liminal place of all, poised perhaps on the brink of non-existence, or about to enter some existence unimagined. She cannot see what hit him, or what he might have hit, or else the street itself had risen up to smite him. "It is not only those things we most fear that do that," she reminds herself.
"It was a match factory," Stone Street says, having greeted her and ushered her into two stories of lofted open plan, dark gleaming hardwood stretching to a wall of glass that opens on a full-length balcony. Candlelight. "We're looking for something else." He's wearing a black cotton dress shirt, its French cuffs unlinked and flapping. The at-home version of that new but slept-in look, she supposes. "It's not Tribeca."
No, it's not, she thinks,
neither in square footage nor in volumes of space. "Hub's on the deck. Just arrived." Drink?
Hub?
Been in Houston.
Stone Street winks.
Bet it would be Hube if they had their druthers.
Hube Big End. Lombard.
Case's dislike of Big End is indeed personal, albeit second-hand, a friend having been involved with the man in New York, back in, as the kids had recently quit saying, the day. Margot, the friend, from Melbourne, had always referred to him as a Lombard, which Case had at first thought might be a reference somehow to his Belgian-ness, until learning, upon finally asking, that it was Margot's acronym for loads of money but a real dickhead. As things had progressed between them, mere Lombardhood had scarcely covered it. Stone Street, at the wet bar sculpted into a corner of the kitchen's granite island, passes her, at her request, a tall glass of ice and fizzy water, garnished with a twist of lemon. On the wall to her left is a triptych by a Japanese artist whose name she forgets, 3 4x8 panels of plywood hung side by side. On these have been silkscreened, in layers, logos and big-eyed manga girls, but each successive layer of paint has been sanded to ghostly translucency, varnished, then overlaid with others, which have in turn been sanded, varnished. The result for Case being very soft, deep, almost soothing, but with the uneasy hallucinatory suggestion of panic about to break through. She turns and sees Big End through glass leading to a balcony, hands on the rain-slick railing, his back to her, in some sort of raincoat, and what seems to be a cowboy hat.
"How do you think we look?" Big End asks. "To the future?"
He looks as though he's somehow, in spite of the evening's cunningly vegan cuisine, been infused with live extract of hot beef. He's florid, glossy, bright-eyed, very likely bushy-tailed as well. The dinner conversation has been mercifully uneventful, with no mention of Dorothea or Blue Ant, and for this, Case is grateful. Helena, Stone Street's wife, has been lecturing them about the uses, even today, in cosmetics, of reprocessed bovine neurological material, having gotten there via a discussion over her stuffed eggplant of spongiform encephalopathy as the price of forcing herbivores into an apocalyptically unnatural cannibalism. Big End has a way of injecting these questions into conversations that he's grown tired of. Caltrips thrown down on the conversational highway. You can swerve, or you can hit them. Blow your tires, hope you'll keep going on the rims. He's been doing it through dinner and their pre-dinner drinks, and Case assumes he does it because he's the boss, and perhaps because he really does bore easily. It's like watching someone restlessly change channels. No more mercy to it than that. "They won't think of us," Case says, choosing straight into it. "Any more than we think of the Victorians. I don't mean the icons, but the ordinary actual living souls." "I think they'll hate us," says Helena, only her gorgeous eyes visible now, above her nightmares of BSE and a spongiform future. She looks, for just that instant, as though she's still in character, as the emotionally conflicted deprogrammer of abductees on Ark Hive 7's lone season, Case having once watched a single episode in order to see a friend's actor boyfriend in a walk-on as a morgue attendant. "Souls," repeats Big End, evidently not having heard Helena, his blue eyes widening for Case's benefit. He has less accent of any kind than she can recall having heard before in any speaker of English. It's unnerving. It makes him sound somehow directionless, like a loudspeaker in a departure lounge, though it has nothing to do with volume. "Souls?" Case looks at him and carefully chews a mouthful of stuffed eggplant. "Of course," he says,
We have no idea now of who or what the inhabitants of our future might be. In that sense, we have no future. Not in the sense that our grandparents had a future, or thought they did. Fully imagined cultural futures were the luxury of another day, one in which now was of some greater duration. For us, of course, things can change so abruptly, so violently, so profoundly, that futures like our grandparents have insufficient now to stand on. We have no future because our present is too volatile. He smiles, a version of Tom Cruise with too many teeth, and longer, but still very white. We have only risk management, the spinning of the given moment scenarios, pattern recognition. Case blinks. Do we have a past then? Stone Street asks. History is a best guess narrative about what happened and when, Big N says, his eyes narrowing. Who did what to whom, with what, who won, who lost, who mutated, who became extinct? The future is there, Case hears herself say, looking back at us, trying to make sense of the fiction we will have become. And from where they are, the past behind us will look nothing at all like the past we imagine behind us now. You sound oracular. White teeth. I only know that the one constant in history is change. The past changes. Our version of the past will interest the future to about the extent we're interested in whatever past the Victorians believed in. It simply won't seem very relevant. What she's actually doing here is channeling Parker Boy from memory, a thread with Filmy and Morris, arguing over whether or not the footage is intended to convey any particular sense of period, or whether the apparently careful lack of period markers might suggest some attitude, on the maker's part, to time and history, and if so, what? Now it's Big N's turn to chew, silently, looking at her very seriously. He drives a maroon Hummer with Belgian plates, wheel on the left. Not the full-on Uber vehicle like a Jeep with glandular problems, but some newer, smaller version that still manages to look no kinder, no gentler. It's almost as uncomfortable as the bigger ones, though the seats are upholstered with glove-soft skin. What she'd liked, all she'd liked, about the big ones had been the huge transmission hump, broad as a horse's back, separating driver from passenger. But of course their effect had changed entirely once the actual original Humvee had become a fixture on the streets of New York. Never her idea of a date vehicle, your old-school Civvy Hummer, and this little one has her closer to Big End, who's placed his chocolate-brown Stetson on the downscaled hump between them. Mirror World Traffic has her foot foolishly working a phantom brake, as though she, seated on the British driver's side, should be doing the driving. She clutches her East German envelope in her lap and tries not to do that. Big End's made it plain that he won't think of her taking a cab, though neither, apparently, would he think of resummoning the blue ant car and its natty driver. Nor will he countenance her suggestion of the tender mercies of the Bow Road tube. The rain is done, the air clear as glass. She spots a cluster of signage denoting things Smithfield as they whip through a roundabout and thinks that they are near the market. "We'll have a drink," Hubertus Big End says, "in Clerkenwell."